The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 10, Side 2.
Conscious instigation of one prisoner against another can lead to just such awful soul mange. In Unschlag in 1950, Mosée Weite, who even though she was touched in the head was still being marched to and from work under convoy, paid no attention to the convoy and went off to look for her mother. She was seized, tied to a post at the gatehouse, and it was announced that, because of her escape attempt, the whole camp would be deprived of the next Sunday. A standard trick. And therefore, as the brigades returned from work, they spat at the trussed-up woman, and some even struck her. "Because of you, bitch, we don't have a rest day." Mosée Weite only smiled benignly. And how much corruption was introduced by that democratic and progressive system of trusty watchmen, which in our Czech terminology became converted to self-guarding, introduced back in 1918. After all, this was one of the main streams of camp corruption, the enlistment of prisoners in the trusty guards. You had fallen. You were punished. You had been uprooted from life, but you want to avoid the very bottom of the pile. You want to hover over someone else, rifle in hand, over your brother? Here, take it, and if he runs, shoot him. We will even call you comrade, and we will give you a Red Army man's ration. And he grows proud, and he tightens his grip on his gun stock, and he shoots, and he is even more severe than the free guards. How is one to understand this? Was it really a purblind faith in social initiative, or was it just an icy, contemptuous calculation based on the lowest human feelings? After all, it was not just a matter of self-guarding, either. There were also self-supervision and self-oppression, right up to the situation in the 30s when all of them, all the way up to the camp chief, were Czechs, including the transport chief, the production chief. And how could it have been otherwise anyway, when there were only 37 Czechists to 100,000 Czechs on the White Sea-Baltic Canal? Yes, and even security chiefs were Czechs too. One could not have carried self-supervision any further than that. The Czechs were conducting interrogations of themselves. They were recruiting stool pigeons to denounce themselves. Yes, yes, but I'm not going to examine those countless cases of corruption here. They're well known to everyone. They have already been described, and they will be described again. It is quite enough to admit they took place. This is the general trend. This is as it should be. Why repeat about each and every house that in sub-zero weather it loses its warmth? It is much more surprising to note that there are houses which retain their warmth even in sub-zero weather. Shalamov says, "Everyone imprisoned in camp was spiritually impoverished. But whenever I recall or encounter a former Czech, I find a real personality." Elsewhere, Shalamov himself writes that he wouldn't betray other Czechs. He wouldn't become a brigadier and compel others to work. Why is that, Varlam Tikhonovich? Why is it that out of a clear sky it appears that you would refuse to become either a stoolie or a brigadier, if it is the case that no one in camp can avoid or sidestep that slippery slope of corruption? Given the fact that truth and falsehood are kin sisters, does it mean that you did nonetheless grasp at some branch sticking out? Does it mean that you found a footing on some stone and did not slide down any further? And maybe, despite everything, anger is not really the most long-lived feeling there is? Do you not refute your own concept with your character and verses? Alas, he decided not to refute it. As if out of stubbornness, he continued this argument. On February the 23rd, 1972, in the Literaturnaya Gazeta, he published a renunciation, for some reason now that all the threats have passed. "The problematics of the Kolyma stories have long since been crossed out by life." This renunciation was printed in a black mourning frame, and thus all of us understood that Shalamov had died. And how is it that genuine religious believers survived in camp, as we mentioned more than once? In the course of this book, we have already mentioned their self-confident procession through the archipelago, a sort of silent religious procession with invisible candles. How some among them were mowed down by machine guns, and those next in line continued their march. A steadfastness unheard of in the 20th century. And it was not in the least for show, and there weren't any declamations. Take some Aunt Dusia Chmil, a round-faced, calm, and quite illiterate old woman. The convoy guards called out to her, "Chmil, what is your article?" And she gently, good-naturedly replied, "Why are you asking, my boy? It's all written down there. I can't remember them all." She had a bouquet of sections under Article 58. "Your term!" Auntie Dusia sighed. She wasn't giving such contradictory answers in order to annoy the convoy. In her own simple-hearted way, she pondered this question. Her term? Did they really think it was given to human beings to know their terms? What term? Till God forgives my sins. Till then, I'll be serving time. "You are a silly, you. A silly!" The convoy guards laughed. 15 years you've got and you'll serve them all. And maybe some more besides. But after 2.5 years of her term had passed, even though she had sent no petitions, all of a sudden a piece of paper came. Release. How could one not envy those people? Were circumstances more favorable for them? By no means. It is a well-known fact that the nuns were kept only with prostitutes and thieves at penalty camps. And yet who was there among the religious believers whose soul was corrupted? They died, most certainly, but they were not corrupted. And how can one explain that certain unstable people found faith right there in camp, that they were strengthened by it, and that they survived uncorrupted? And many more, scattered about and unnoticed, came to their allotted turning point and made no mistake in their choice. Those who managed to see that things were not only bad for them, but even worse, even harder, for their neighbors. And all those who, under the threat of a penalty zone and a new term of imprisonment, refused to become stoolies. How, in general, can one explain Grigory Ivanovich Grigoriev, a soil scientist, a scientist who volunteered for the People's Volunteer Corps in 1941? And the rest of the story is a familiar one. Taken prisoner near Vyazma, he spent his whole captivity in a German camp. And the subsequent story is also familiar. When he returned, he was arrested by us and given a tenner. I came to know him in winter, engaged in general work in Ekipastutz. His forthrightness gleamed from his big, quiet eyes, some sort of unwavering forthrightness. This man was never able to bow in spirit. And he didn't bow in camp either. Even though he worked only 2 of his 10 years in his own field of specialization and didn't receive food parcels from home for nearly the whole term. He was subjected on all sides to the camp philosophy, to the camp corruption of soul, but he was incapable of adopting it. In the Kemerovo camps, Antibes, the security chief kept trying to recruit him as a stoolie. Grigoriev replied to him quite honestly and candidly, "I find it quite repulsive to talk to you. You will find many willing without me. You bastard, you'll crawl on all fours. I would be better off hanging myself on the first branch." And so he was sent off to a penalty situation. He stood it for 1/2 a year, and he made mistakes which were even more unforgivable. When he was sent on an agricultural work party, he refused, as a soil scientist, to accept the post of brigadier offered him. He hoed and scythed with enthusiasm. And even more stupidly, in Ekibastutz at the stone quarry, he refused to be a work checker, only because he would have had to pad the worksheets for the sloggers, for which later on, when they caught up with it, the eternally drunk free foreman would have to pay the penalty. But would he? And so he went to break rocks. His honesty was so monstrously unnatural that when he went out to process potatoes with the vegetable store and brigade, he did not steal any, though everyone else did. When he was in a good post in the privileged repair shop brigade at the pumping station equipment, he left simply because he refused to wash the socks of the free bachelor construction supervisor, Trevish. His fellow brigade members tried to persuade him, Come on now, isn't it all the same, the kind of work you do? But no, it turned out it was not at all the same to him. How many times did he select the worst and hardest lot just so as not to have to offend against conscience? And he didn't, not in the least, and I am a witness. And even more, because of the astounding influence on his body of his bright and spotless human spirit, though no one today believes in any such influence, no one understands it. The organism of Grigory Ivanovich, who was no longer young, close to 50, grew stronger in camp. His earlier rheumatism of the joints disappeared completely, and he became particularly healthy after the typhus from which he recovered. In winter, he went out in cotton sacks, making holes in them for his head and his arms, and he did not catch cold. So wouldn't it be more correct to say that no camp can corrupt those who have a stable nucleus, who do not accept that pitiful ideology which holds that human beings are created for happiness, an ideology which is done in by the first blow of the worker signer's cudgel? Those people became corrupted in camp who before camp had not been enriched by any morality at all or by any spiritual upbringing. This is not at all a theoretical matter, since during our glorious half-century millions of them grew up. Those people became corrupted in camp who had already been corrupted out in freedom or who were ready for it. Because people are corrupted in freedom too, sometimes even more effectively than in camp. The convoy officer who ordered that Moisey Vaite be tied to a post in order to be mocked, had he not been corrupted more profoundly than the camp inmates who spat on her? And for that matter, did every one of the brigade members spit on her? Perhaps only two from each brigade did. In fact, that is probably what happened. Tatiana Falike writes, "Observation of people convinced me that no man could become a scoundrel in camp if he had not been one before. If a person went swiftly bad in camp, what it might mean was that he had not just gone bad, but that that inner foulness which had not previously been needed had disclosed itself. M. A. Voitchenko has his opinion. In camp, existence did not determine consciousness, but just the opposite. Consciousness and steadfast faith in the human essence decided whether you became an animal or remained a human being." A drastic, sweeping declaration. But he was not the only one who thought so. The artist Ivashev Musatov passionately argued exactly the same thing. Yes, camp corruption was a mass phenomenon, but not only because the camps were awful, but because, in addition, we Soviet people stepped upon the soil of the archipelago spiritually disarmed, long since prepared to be corrupted, already tinged by it out in freedom. And we strained our ears to hear from the old camp veterans how to live in camp. But we ought to have known how to live and how to die without any camp. And perhaps, Varlam Tikhonovich Shalamov, as a general rule, friendship between people does arise in need and misfortune, even in extreme misfortune too, but not between such withered and nasty people as we were, given our decades of upbringing. If corruption was so inevitable, then why did Olga Lvovna Schliotsberg not abandon her freezing friend on the forest trail, but stay behind for nearly certain death together with her, and save her? Wasn't that an extreme of misfortune? And if corruption was so inevitable, then where did Vasily Mefodyevich Yakovenko spring from? He served out 2 terms, had only just been released, was living as a free employee in Vorkuta, and was just beginning to crawl around without an escort and acquire his first tiny nest. It was 1949. In Vorkuta, they began to rearrest former Zeks and give them new sentences. An arrest psychosis. There was panic among the free employees. How could they hold on to their freedom? How could they be less noticeable? But why D. Grodzensky, a friend of Yakovenko from the same Vorkuta camp, was arrested? During the interrogation, he was losing strength and was close to death. There was no one to bring him food parcels. And Yakovenko fearlessly brought him food parcels. "If you want to, you dogs, rake me in too." Why was this man not corrupted? And do not all those who survived remember one or another person who reached out a hand to him in camp and saved him at a difficult moment? Yes, the camps were calculated and intended to corrupt, but this didn't mean that they succeeded in crushing everyone. Just as in nature the process of oxidation never occurs without an accompanying reduction, one substance oxidizes while at the same time another reduces, so in camp too, and everywhere in life, there is no corruption without ascent. They exist alongside one another. In the next part, I hope still to show how in other camps, in the special camps, a different environment was created after a certain time. The process of corruption was greatly hampered, and the process of ascent became attractive even to the camp careerists. Well, and what about correction? How did things go with correction, after all? Correction is a social and state concept and does not coincide with ascent. All the systems of justice in the world, not just our own, dream that criminals will not merely serve out their term, but will also become corrected in the process. In other words, behave so as not to return to the defendant's bench in court, particularly for the same offence. Nonetheless, they never strove to correct the 58s, in other words, to avoid imprisoning them a second time. We have already cited the frank statements of the penologists on this subject. They wanted to exterminate the 58s through labour, and the fact that we survived was due to our own initiative. Dostoevsky exclaims, "Whom did hard labor ever correct?" The ideal of correction existed in Russian legislation after the Great Reform. The whole of Chekhov's Sakhalin grew out of that ideal. But was it ever successfully implemented? P. Yakubovich thought about this a great deal and wrote, "The terrorist regimen of hard labor corrects only those who have not become depraved, but they would not commit a second crime even without it. Yet this regimen only depraves a corrupt person, compelling him to be sly and hypocritical, and to do his utmost not to leave any clues behind. What can one say about our corrective labor camps? Students of penology, Gefangniskunde, always believed that a prisoner must not be driven to total despair, that he must always be left hope and a way out. The reader has already seen that our corrective labor camps drove prisoners only and precisely to total despair. Chekhov spoke truly. Soul-searching, that is what's truly needed for correction. But it was soul-searching that the managers of our camps feared most of all. The common barracks, brigades, work collectives were all specially designed to disperse and dismember that dangerous soul-searching. What sort of correction could there be in our camps? All they could do was damage, instill the thieves' morality, instill the cruel camp ways as the general law of life. Criminogenic places, in the penologist's language. In other words, crime schools. I.G. Pisarev, when he was completing his lengthy prison sentence, wrote in 1963, "It becomes particularly hard because you leave here an incurable nervous wreck, with your health irreparably ruined by lack of proper food and by incessant incitement. Here people are corrupted once and for all. Maybe butter wouldn't have melted in a man's mouth before, but now you'd never manage to put salt on his tail. If you say pig to a person for 7 years, he will end up by grunting. It is only the first year that punishes the prisoner. All the rest simply embitter him. He adapts to the conditions, and that is all. The law, with its long sentences and its cruelty, punishes the criminal's family more than it does him." Here is another letter. "It is painful and frightening to leave life without having seen anything and without having done anything, and no one even cares about you except, in all likelihood, your mother, who never ceases to wait for you her whole life long." And here is what Alexander Kuzmich K., who devoted much thought to the matter, wrote in 1963. "They commuted my sentence of execution to 20 years of hard labor, but to be quite honest, I don't consider that to have been any favor to me. I experienced those mistakes, as it is now the style to call them, on my own skin and bones, and they were in no way any easier or better than those of Auschwitz or Majdanek. How is one supposed to distinguish dirt from truth, a murderer from an instructor, the law from lawlessness, an executioner from a patriot? When he moves upwards, and from being a lieutenant becomes a lieutenant colonel, and the cockade he wears on his hat is very much like the one worn before 1917. And how am I, emerging after 18 years of imprisonment, supposed to decipher all the obfuscations? I envy you educated people who have flexible minds and who do not have to spend a long time breaking your heads in order to figure out how you should proceed or how you should adapt, which in fact I do not want to do. Well spoken indeed. I do not want. With feelings like that on his release, can one say that he was corrupted? But was he then corrected in the state's sense? Of course not. For the state, he has simply been ruined. See what he has come to understand. This was no different from Auschwitz, and the cockades are no different either. The correction which the state would like, yes, is by and large never attained in the camps. The graduates of the camp learn only to be two-faced, how to pretend to be corrected, and they learn cynicism toward the appeals of the state, the laws of the state, and its promises. And what if there is nothing for a person to be corrected of, if he is not a criminal at all in the first place, if he has been imprisoned because he prayed to God, or expressed an independent opinion, or became a prisoner of war, or because of his father, or simply to fulfill the prisoner arrest quota? What then could the camps give him? The Sakhalin prison inspector said to Chekhov, "If in the final analysis, out of 100 hard labor prisoners, 15 to 20 emerge as decent men, the responsibility for this result lies not so much with the corrective measures we employ as with our Russian courts, which send so many good, reliable elements to hard labor." Well, that judgment can stand for the archipelago, too, provided we increase the proportion of the innocently sentenced to, say, 80%, without at the same time forgetting that in our camps the percentage of spoilage was also considerably higher. If we are speaking not about the meat grinder for unwanted millions, not about the cesspool into which they were hurled without pity for the people, but about a serious correctional system, the most complex of questions arises. How is it possible to give monotonously uniform punishments on the basis of a single, unified criminal code? After all, externally equal punishments for different individuals, some more moral and others more corrupted, some more sensitive and some more crude, some educated and some uneducated, are completely unequal punishments. See Dostoevsky in many different places in his The House of the Dead. English thought has understood this, and they say there, I don't know how much they practice it, that the punishment must fit not only the crime, but also the character of each criminal. For example, the general loss of external freedom for a person with a rich inner world is less hard to bear than for a person who is immature, who lives more in terms of the flesh. This second person requires more in terms of external impressions, and his instincts pull him more strongly in the direction of freedom. Yakubovich. The first finds it easier to be in solitary confinement, especially with books. Ah, how some of us thirsted for that kind of imprisonment instead of camp. When the body is confined, what broad horizons are open to the mind and the soul. Nikolai Morozov did not seem in any way remarkable either before his arrest, or, which is the more surprising, after it. But prison meditation provided him with the chance to conceive of the planetary structure of the atom, with its differentially charged nucleus and electrons, 10 years before Rutherford. But we were never offered pencils, paper, and books, and even had every last one of them taken away from us. The second kind of prisoner, on the other hand, might not be able to stand solitary confinement for even a year, and would simply wither away and die off. He would need someone, companions. And yet, for the former kind of prisoner, unpleasant company could be worse than no one. But camp, where they gave very little food, would be much easier for the latter to bear than for the former. as would a barracks where 400 people were housed, all of them shouting, playing the fool, playing cards and dominoes, howling and snoring, and where, on top of all that, the radio, which was aimed at idiots, was constantly screeching away. The camps in which I served time were punished by having no radio. What a salvation that was. Thus the system of corrective labour camps in particular, with their obligatory and exhausting physical labour, and their obligatory participation in the humiliating, buzzing ant heap, was a more effective means of destroying the intelligentsia than was prison. It was precisely the intelligentsia that this system killed off quickly and completely. Chapter 3. Our Muzzled Freedom. But even when all the main things about the Gulag Archipelago are written, read, and understood, will there be anyone even then who grasps what our freedom was like? What sort of a country it was that for whole decades dragged that archipelago about inside itself? It was my fate to carry inside me a tumour the size of a large man's fist. This tumour swelled and distorted my stomach, hindered my eating and sleeping, and I was always conscious of it, though it did not constitute even 0.5% of my body, whereas within the country as a whole the archipelago constituted 8%. But the horrifying thing was not that this tumour pressed upon and displaced adjacent organs. What was most terrifying about it was that it exuded poisons and infected the whole body. And in this same way our whole country was infected by the poisons of the archipelago, and whether it will ever be able to get rid of them some day, only God knows. Can we, dare we, describe the full loathsomeness of the state in which we lived? Not so remote from that of today. And if we do not show that loathsomeness in its entirety, then we at once have a lie. For this reason I consider that literature did not exist in our country in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, because without the full truth it is not literature. And today they show this loathsomeness according to the fashion of the moment, by inference, an inserted phrase, an afterthought, or hint. And the result is again a lie. This is not the task of our book, but let us try to enumerate briefly those traits of free life which were determined by the closeness of the archipelago, or which were in the same style. 1. Constant fear. As the reader has already seen, the roster of the waves of recruitment into the archipelago is not exhausted with 1935 or 1937 or 1949. The recruitment went on all the time. Just as there is no minute when people are not dying or being born, so there was no minute when people were not being arrested. Sometimes this came close to a person, sometimes it was further off. Sometimes a person deceived himself into thinking that nothing threatened him. And sometimes he himself became an executioner, and thus the threat to him diminished. But any adult inhabitant of this country, from a collective farmer up to a member of the Politburo, always knew that it would take only one careless word or gesture, and he would fly off irrevocably into the abyss. Just as in the archipelago beneath every trustee lay the chasm and death of general work, so beneath every inhabitant lay the chasm and death of the archipelago. In appearance, the country was much bigger than its archipelago, but all of it and all its inhabitants hung phantom-like above the latter's gaping maw. Fear was not always the fear of arrest. There were intermediate threats, purges, inspections, the completion of security questionnaires, routine or extraordinary ones, dismissal from work, deprivation of residence permit, expulsion or exile. In addition, there were such little known forms as expulsion from the party, dismissal from work, and dispatch to a camp as a free worker. That is how Stepan Grigorievich Onchul was exiled in 1938. It was natural that such persons were listed as being very unreliable. During the war, Onchul was conscripted into a work battalion, where he died. The security questionnaires were so detailed and so inquisitive that more than half the inhabitants of the country had a bad conscience, and were constantly and permanently tormented by the approach of the period when they had to be filled out. Once people had invented a false life story for these questionnaires, they had to try not to get tangled up in it. But danger might strike suddenly. The son of the Kadi Vlasov, Igor, regularly entered in his questionnaire the statement that his father was dead, and that way he got into a military school. Then one fine day he was summoned, and he had 3 days to present a certificate of his father's death. And he had to do it. The aggregate fear led to a correct consciousness of one's own insignificance and of the lack of any kind of rights. In November 1938, Natasha Anichkova learned that the person she loved, her common-law husband, had been arrested in Orel. She went there. The enormous square in front of the prison was filled with carts. On them sat women in bast sandals, wearing their traditional peasant dress, with parcels which the authorities refused to accept. Anichkova pushed her way up to a window in a dreadful prison wall. "Who are you?" they asked her sternly. They heard her out. "Well, now listen here, comrade Muscovite. I am going to give you one piece of advice. Get out of here today, because at night they're going to come for you, too." The foreigner finds all this quite incomprehensible. Why had the Czechist given her unsolicited advice instead of a business-like answer to her question? What right did he have to demand of a free citizen that she leave immediately? And who was going to come, and why? But what Soviet citizen will lie and say that this is incomprehensible to him, or that it sounds like an improbable case? After advice like that, you would be afraid to stay in a strange city. Nadezhda Mandelstam speaks truly when she remarks that our life is so permeated with prison that simple, meaningful words like "they took," or "they put inside," or "he is inside," or "they let out," are understood by everyone in our country in only one sense, even without a context. Peace of mind is something our citizens have never known. 2. Servitude. If it had been easy to change your place of residence, to leave a place that had become dangerous for you, and thus shake off fear and refresh yourself, people would have behaved more boldly, and they might have taken some risks. But for long decades we were shackled by that same system under which no worker could quit work of his own accord. And the passport regulations also fastened everyone to particular places, and the housing, which could not be sold, nor exchanged, nor rented. And because of this, it was an insane piece of daring to protest in the place where you lived or worked. 3. Secrecy and mistrust. These feelings replaced our former open-hearted cordiality and hospitality, which had still not been destroyed in the 20s. These feelings were the natural defense of any family and every person, particularly because no one could ever quit work or leave, and every little detail was kept in sight and within earshot for years. The secretiveness of the Soviet person is by no means superfluous, but is absolutely necessary, even though to a foreigner it may at times seem superhuman. The former Tsarist officer K.U. survived and was never arrested only because when he got married he did not tell his wife about his past. His brother N.U. was arrested, and the wife of the arrested man, taking advantage of the fact that they lived in different cities at the time of his arrest, hid his arrest from her own father and mother, so they would not blurt it out. She preferred telling them and everyone else that her husband had abandoned her, and then playing that role a long time. Now these were the secrets of one family, which I was told 30 years later. And what urban family did not have such secrets? In 1949, the father of a girl who was a fellow student of V.I.'s was arrested. In these cases, everyone would shun such a student, and that was considered natural. But V.I. did not shun her, and openly expressed sympathy with the girl, and tried to find ways to help her out. Frightened by such unusual conduct, the girl rejected V.I.'s help and participation, and lied to him, saying she did not believe in the innocence of her arrested father, and that he had evidently concealed his crime from his family all his life. And it was only during the times of Khrushchev that their tongues were loosened. The girl told him she had decided he was either a police informer or else a member of an anti-Soviet organization out to rope in the dissatisfied. This universal mutual mistrust had the effect of deepening the mass grave pit of slavery. The moment someone began to speak up frankly, everyone stepped back and shunned him. A provocation. And therefore, anyone who burst out with a sincere protest was predestined to loneliness and alienation. 4. Universal ignorance. Hiding things from each other and not trusting each other, we ourselves helped implement that absolute secrecy, absolute misinformation, among us, which was the cause of causes of everything that took place, including both the millions of arrests and the mass approval of them also. Informing one another of nothing, neither shouting nor groaning, and learning nothing from one another, we were completely in the hands of the newspapers and the official orators. Every day they pushed in our faces some new piece of incitement, like a photograph of a railroad wreck, sabotage, somewhere 3,000 miles away. And what we really needed to learn about, which is what had happened on our apartment landing that day, we had no way of finding out. How could you become a citizen, knowing nothing about life around you? Only when you yourself were caught in the trap would you find out. Too late. 5. Squealing was developed to a mind-boggling extent. Hundreds of thousands of security officers in their official offices, in the innocent rooms of official buildings, and in prearranged apartments, sparing neither paper nor their unoccupied time, tirelessly recruited and summoned stool pigeons to give reports, and this in such enormous numbers as they could never have found necessary for collecting information. They even recruited obviously useless and unsuitable people who would most certainly not agree to report to them. For example, a religious believer, the wife of the Baptist minister Nikitin, who had died in camp. Nonetheless, she was kept standing for several hours while being questioned, then was arrested, and then transferred to worse work at her factory. One of the purposes of such extensive recruitment was, evidently, to make each subject feel the breath of the stool pigeons on his own skin, so that in every group of people, in every office, in every apartment, either there would be an informer or else the people there would be afraid there was. I will give my own superficial speculative estimate. Out of every 4 to 5 city dwellers, there would most certainly be one who at least once in his life had received a proposal to become an informer. And it might even have been more widespread than that. Quite recently, I carried out my own spot check, both among groups of ex-prisoners and among groups of those who have always been free. I asked which out of the group they had tried to recruit and when and how, and it turned out that out of several people at a table, all had received such proposals at one time or another. Nadezhda Mandelstam correctly concludes, "Beyond the purpose of weakening ties between people, there was another purpose as well. Any person who had let himself be recruited would, out of fear of public exposure, be very much interested in the continuing stability of the regime. Secretiveness spread its cold tentacles throughout the whole people. It crept between colleagues' work, between old friends, students, soldiers, neighbors, children growing up, and even into the reception room of the NKVD, among the prisoners' wives bringing food parcels." 6. Betrayal as a form of existence. Given this constant fear over a period of many years, for oneself and one's family, a human being became a vassal of fear, subjected to it. And it turned out that the least dangerous form of existence was constant betrayal. The mildest, and at the same time most widespread form of betrayal, was not to do anything bad directly, but just not to notice the doomed person next to one, not to help him, to turn away one's face, to shrink back. They had arrested a neighbor, your comrade at work, or even your close friend. You kept silence. You acted as if you had not noticed, for you could not afford to lose your current job. And then it was announced at work, at the general meeting, that the person who had disappeared the day before was an inveterate enemy of the people, and you, who had bent your back beside him for 20 years at the same desk, now by your noble silence, or even by your condemning speech, had to show how hostile you were to his crimes. You had to make this sacrifice for the sake of your own dear family, for your own dear ones, what right had you not to think about them? But the person arrested had left behind him a wife, a mother, children, and perhaps they at least ought to be helped? No, no, that would be dangerous. After all, these were the wife of an enemy and the mother of an enemy, and they were the children of an enemy, and your own children had a long education ahead of them. When they arrested Engineer Palchinsky, his wife Nina wrote to Kropotkin's widow, "I have been left without any funds, and no one has given me any help. All shun me and fear me, and I have found out what friends are now. There are very few exceptions." A letter of August the 16th, 1929, manuscript section of the Lenin Library, collection 410, card file 5, storage unit 24. And one who concealed an enemy was also an enemy, and one who abetted an enemy was also an enemy, and one who continued his friendship with an enemy was also an enemy. And the telephone of the accursed family fell silent, and they stopped getting letters, and on the street people passed them without recognizing them, without offering them a hand to shake, without nodding to them. And even less were they invited out, and no one offered to lend them money, and in the hustle of a big city people felt as if they were in a desert. And that was precisely what Stalin needed, and he laughed in his mustaches, the shoeshine boy. Academician Sergei Vavilov, after the repression of his great brother, became a lackey president of the Academy of Sciences. That moustached prankster thought it all up, too, to make a fool of him and as a test for the human heart. A.N. Tolstoy, a Soviet count, avoided not only visiting but even giving money to the family of his arrested brother. Leonid Leonov forbade his own wife, whose maiden name was Sabashnikova, to visit the family of her arrested brother, S.M. Sabashnikov. And the legendary Georgi Dmitrov, that roaring lion of the Leipzig trial, retreated and declined to save, and even betrayed, his friends Popov and Tanev when they, who had been acquitted by a fascist court, got sentenced to 15 years each on Soviet soil for the attempted assassination of Comrade Dmitrov, and they served time in Kraslak. It is well known what the situation of an arrested man's family was like. V. Y. Kavashan from Kaluga recalls it. "After the arrest of our father, everyone avoided and shunned us as if we were lepers, and I had to leave school because the children tormented me." More betrayers were growing up, more executioners growing up. "And my mother was fired from her work, and we had to resort to begging." One family of a Muscovite arrested in 1937, a mother and little children, was being taken to the railroad station by the police to be sent into exile. And all of a sudden, when they went through the station, the small boy, aged 8, disappeared. The policemen wore themselves out looking for him but couldn't find him. So they exiled the family without the boy. And what had happened was that he dived under the red cloth wound around the high pedestal beneath the bust of Stalin, and he sat there until the danger passed. And then he returned home, where the apartment was sealed shut. He went to the neighbors, and to acquaintances, and to friends of his papa and mama, and not only did no one take that small boy into their family, but they refused even to let him spend the night. And so he went and turned himself in at an orphanage. Contemporaries, fellow citizens, do you recognize here your own swinish faces? But all that was only the minimal degree of betrayal to turn one's back. But how many other alluring degrees there were, and what a multitude of people descended them. Those who fired Kavashan's mother from work, did they not also turn their backs and make their own contribution? Those who hearkened to the ring of the security men and sent Nikitin's wife to manual labor, so that she would give in and become a stoolie all the sooner. Yes, and those editors who rushed to cross off the name of the writer who had been arrested the day before. Marshal Blücher, he is a symbol of that epoch, he sat like an owl in the presidium of the court and judged Tukhachevsky, and Tukhachevsky would have done the same to him. They shot Tukhachevsky, and then they cut off Blücher's head, too. Or what about the famous medical professors Vinogradov and Sherashevsky? This book is continued on Cassette 11, Side 1.